Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. HIV is a sexually transmitted infection that can also be spread by contact from infected blood or from a mother to a child during pregnancy, childbirth, and even breastfeeding. This infection then damages your immune system and it interferes with your body's ability to fight the infection. After years, HIV infection affects your immune system to the point where it's weakened, and we now say you have AIDS, making you then susceptible to a vast range of other infections. There's no cure for HIV or AIDS, but there are medications that dramatically slow the progression of the disease. Today we're going to explore some basic information about HIV and AIDS, resources in Alaska, and what's happening in Alaska regarding HIV and AIDS. My guests are Dr. Beth Saltonstall. She is the medical director of the HIV and AIDS Clinical Services at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, and Heather Davis, executive director of Alaska AIDS Assistance Association. If you'd like to reach us at any time during the next hour or so with questions or comments, our local number in Anchorage is 550-8433. Our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Heather, welcome.
Thank you.
Beth, welcome.
Thank you.
Back. You told me you've done this before.
I have.
So we've done programs on AIDS and HIV almost on a regularly, roughly a yearly basis for several years. And Heather, you've recently just joined the Alaska AIDS Assistance Association.
I did. I joined the 1st of July of this year.
So remind us about that program. What's it all about?
Sure. Well, the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association, also known as the 4As, was formed in 1985, not long after the epidemic started. And its mission has been to be a key collaborator with the state of Alaska in the provision of supportive services to people living with HIV and AIDS and their families, and then also to work towards the elimination of HIV transmission and the stigma that still surrounds this disease. So our core areas are providing HIV supportive services for clients and their families, and then also educating the public about HIV.
Where's the funding coming from?
We get funding from the state, from feds and state. We rely on a lot of private foundation grants, and then from donors are a huge source of financial support for us.
And Dr. Saltonstall, tell us a little bit about what's happening at the Native Native Medical Center.
Our HIV program started in 2001. We were recipients of the federal HRSA grant for Ryan White grant for funds to do care and case management for people who are living with HIV. So our team group started in 2002 in March, and we've been doing HIV since that time. And we're also part of the Northwest AIDS Education and Training Center, so we provide educational services for providers around the state as well. We see Alaska Native American Indian patients at the ANTHC Internal Medicine Clinic. And then we have a clinic up in the interior community health up in Fairbanks that we go up quarterly to see patients there. Mm-hmm. We provide direct care, but we also encourage people to call us with questions about case management for patients that they may have, for questions about HIV care, for people who just have questions about HIV itself. We encourage anyone to give us a call, and we're always happy to chat.
And we collaborate closely with each other on clients that we share. So case managers from the 4As will meet monthly with the case managers from the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and also with the Anchorage Native Health Center, which is a big provider.
This is kind of a little bit off task a little bit, but you know, one of the big problems I have as a provider all the time is where do I go to get reliable information quickly? I guess actually that's what the public wants to know too. But for us, it may be with a patient sitting in my office, and you said you provide consultations about that. Now, normally I would probably call one of the infectious disease guys here in town, but you're also available to physicians or providers throughout the state, it sounds like, that they can call or get in touch with you about questions.
Anytime. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's all we do. Our direct number is 907-729-2907 will get you to the front desk, and any of us can generally field questions and give you some assistance in either answering your questions or giving you places to find the answers that you might be looking for.
And the other thing I guess I should bring up is one of the reasons we meet or talk about HIV and AIDS on a regular basis is for several years there's been a World AIDS Day, which is, I recall, December 1st of each year.
Yeah, World AIDS Day is December 1st of each year. It's an opportunity for people worldwide to unite in the fight against HIV, show their support of people living with this disease, and also to commemorate those who have died. And it's interesting to note that World AIDS Day was the first ever Global Health Day being held in 1988. And this year, it's a Saturday this year, so World AIDS Day will be held from 4 to 6. Everybody will meet at Voth Hall at the Performing Arts Center and have the candlelight vigil afterwards. So we encourage people to attend and show their support.
Any other activities, or is that the primary?
That's the primary activity, yes.
And where's the meeting going to be?
We'll meet at Voth Hall in the Performing Arts Center at 4 o'clock on December 1st, Saturday, and then we'll go out to the park afterwards for the candlelighting ceremony.
It has, the idea about AIDS and HIV appears to me from talking with people changed a lot. It's not as commonly in our psyche as it used to be. Maybe that's the thing. Is that fair to say?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. I think part of that is a lot of people don't remember the old days, the early 80s, when we were first finding out about HIV and AIDS and the horrible diseases and the Kaposi sarcoma and horrible effects that HIV and AIDS had on people. Now, with our new therapies, HIV is a chronic disease. So it's not on the forefront. You're not seeing the people who are ill and dying of the disease like you did in the early days. It's a treatable disease now. So I think it's become so commonplace that it's not as big a worry. It's not as big a fear as it used to be in the early 80s.
When it's not commonplace, when it's not in our psyche, when we're not reading about it on the front page or Newsweek or hearing about it on the internet all the time, then we have a tendency as humans to forget about what's happened. Bring us up to date a little bit. What is this HIV virus? Why was it killing millions, and why are millions still infected?
When HIV was first raising its head back in the early 80s, and actually, if you look back through the science, we think that HIV has probably been around since the 1930s. It's just that travel and war and other things have allowed it to spread. It was originally a simian immunodeficiency virus and was spread from primates to humans, probably like we cut fish, we put up meat, we cut our hands. So it was probably an inoculation as monkeys and chimpanzees were food. And when it first started, we had no idea what it was. People were showing up with Kaposi sarcoma. They were showing up with pneumocystis pneumonia, diseases that were very rare, but were seen primarily in young men who had sex with men. And through the time, it has become known what HIV is. We know how it works in the body. It affects those cells that are supposed to fight it and get rid of it. It sets up factories in those very cells that are supposed to help you. And as you mentioned in your introduction, then it slowly decreases those CD4 cells, which are part of your immune system, and sets you up for possibility of other diseases, which can then by definition be AIDS. Now, through time, we've developed therapies where we have one pill once a day. It may have four or three drugs in it. And it may be the size of your thumb, but you can take one pill once a day. And people, the latest word is that a 25-year-old that's diagnosed with HIV today gets into care, gets on therapy, and stays on therapy, basically has a normal lifespan. Hmm. It's work. It's not perhaps normal, as you want to put parentheses around it, but they can live a normal lifespan.
Mm-hmm. And prior to the modern treatment, and now we're only talking 30 years, mm-hmm. I mean, amazing amount of knowledge and response to that knowledge to control this infection. Well, and we'll get to maybe why we can't cure it, but within a 30-year period of time when it became recognized as a significant issue. What was it like before? What was the lifespan? What happened to virtually everyone who became infected?
When the virus first starts, you may have an acute HIV syndrome you feel like you have the flu. Lymph nodes can be enlarged, sore throat, fever, rash. The rash can be on the palms of your hands, soles of your feet. And then it may go away. And for 5 to 10 years, you have no idea that you have that virus. Oftentimes, it's mistaken for mono, the acute HIV infection. And for 5 to 10 years, you may be just building up and building up. The virus may be getting a better and bigger hold on you. And then after that time, you start getting these diseases, the pneumocystis, the Kaposi sarcoma, and the other things that defined it as AIDS, and then you died.
Pretty quickly.
A relatively short period of time.
Right. And that's, you know, that's a continuum. They say 5 to 10 years, but we have seen people who have developed AIDS within a year or have, then there's a small percentage of people, 3 to 5% of people, who never develop AIDS and can actually control the virus.
Right.
So those are people when you talk about cures and vaccines. number one, good genetics.
Good
they
genes.
Pick their parents, right?
Yeah.
And number two, they're a really high area of research looking to see why some people do not develop HIV or develop AIDS.
Let me remind listeners again, my guests today are Beth Saltonstall. She's the medical director of the HIV/AIDS Clinical Services at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, and Heather Davis, executive director, relatively new executive director at the Alaska AIDS Assistance Association. So we're talking about HIV and AIDS. We've been kind of going over the basics, and then we'll get into a little bit more about what's available and a little bit more information. And certainly we want to answer your questions and hear your comments about these problems. There's ways to do that. You can call us, 550-8433. That's our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And if you're new, you got to spell out line one, L-I-N-E-O-N-E. What else do we need to know about your organization, Heather? What kind of services specifically should we perhaps hear about?
Well, right now we serve over 250 individuals living with HIV, and most of that is through case management. So we provide them with housing assistance, with counseling, with transportation assistance, food, medication management, and making sure they get to their health care provider. The other piece of our work is education and prevention, how to reduce the transmission of this disease and the stigma that's still associated with this disease. And we do that through free HIV testing, educational presentations, street outreach, safer sex kit distribution, and we also have a syringe exchange. And I think it's really important to note that there is still like a million people in the United States living with HIV and AIDS. We continue to see new cases every year. 34 million people worldwide, and over 30 million have died from this disease, making it one of the largest pandemics ever. Correct, Beth?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they provide just incredible assistance for us with our patients. The cooperation is really terrific, because one of the things that we see with HIV is oftentimes the people affected may not have the capacity to either get the transportation or have the ability to get housing. And those are such important things to have in the background in order to successfully treat someone with the antiretroviral therapies we have available today.
Before we came on the air, as we were kind of talking back and forth, you said it's really, there is virtually no reason, and I want to expand on that, why patients cannot get access to treatment today. Tell me if I'm misquoting either one of you. And why is that the case? I mean, there are certainly individuals in our society today who are uninsured, and this treatment I know can't be inexpensive. Anything that goes on for the rest of your life, even if it wasn't very expensive, gets kind of expensive. So why is it that all that treatment is available and that people can get it if they need it?
One of the important resources that is out there for people is the AIDS Drug Assistance Program, better known as the ADAP program, which can provide HIV-related prescription drugs to uninsured and underinsured individuals. So, for instance, right now we have 95 people who are receiving drugs because of this program. These funds are authorized under Title II of the Ryan White Comprehensive Act. And we're really lucky in the state of Alaska that we don't have a waiting list. There are states that have waiting lists for people to get onto their medications, but here in Alaska we don't. So this makes it really much easier for people to access prescription drugs, which are highly expensive and otherwise would be out of their reach.
And that's regardless of whether, I'm just guessing, for certainly for people who don't have health insurance mm-hmm. and have too much of an income or for one other reason don't qualify for Medicaid.
Right. This is a payer of last resort. So uh-huh. if there are no other ways for them to access uh-huh. medications.
Uh-huh. And that would be the most likely reason is there's still several million, I don't know, 20, 30 million people in the United States who don't have any health insurance and would not qualify for Medicaid. I think that's somewhere in the number. Yeah. So that is that the biggest source of people who take advantage of this ADP program, or are there also people who, despite the having health insurance, the costs of the drugs are, and treatment is too expensive?
Well, first they would look at all their other resources right. that they right. have available, and if those don't meet it, then they can come to us and see if we can get them on under ADAP. As long as they meet the guidelines required for it, we can do that.
Beth, we have a couple of questions. One, I'm going to direct to you. That's come in an email. It's basically signed by somebody who says he's a coworker of yours. So he's encouraging us to get certain information available. It says, could we talk a little bit about HIV non-progressors? Yeah, I know about the individuals who don't get infected. And I guess this to me is a little different question. That's why I wanted to ask it, is why do some people HIV infection do not progress? And maybe it's the same reason that some people seem to not even get infected in the first place.
Well, that's where some of our really interesting science comes in. You may have heard about the Berlin patient,
Absolutely.
The man who
yep.
lived.
Yep.
He's the Harry Potter of the HIV mm-hmm. world. He was infected with HIV and developed or was on medications, moved to Germany, and came down with lymphoma. So he was treated for the lymphoma. It worked the first time, but then he had a resurgence of it. And so when they decided to do a stem cell transplant on him, they specifically looked for a person with the correct genetics. Now, when you look at a CD4 cell, there's a couple of things that have to happen for HIV to get into the cell. There's a CD4 receptor. So if you picture a little cup, the HIV hits in the cup.
Sitting on the outside, and that's where it docks.
Yep.
Okay.
And then there's a co-receptor that's down beside that is necessary for the receptor to bend down and actually put the genetic code material into the CD4 to get into its mechanism to start making more copies of itself.
Okay.
And they have found that there are a certain percentage of people, like 5% of people, that don't have that co-receptor. So when they look for the stem cell transplant, they found somebody that did not have those co-receptors. And they transplanted that guy's stem cells into this Tim Brown. And he is about 4+ years out now. And depending on what source you read, he's never had any virus, and they're having a hard time finding virus except for some sequestered virus in tissue.
So basically what happened is a man who's already infected, already his life is probably going to end because of this infection, or at least be long-lasting, ended up getting a disease that required them to have a bone marrow transplant, which basically changed his immune system.
Right.
And so now, if the virus is there, I mean, it can't infect the new cells. And so, in a sense, he's cured, mm-hmm. in quotes, mm-hmm. of his HIV infection. So we know there are those rare individuals who genetically have altered immune cells that are the target of the HIV infection. So despite right. the fact that they may become infected, they do not have sequelae of that infection. Infection being acquiring the illness, but they don't get disease because of
it. Right. Now, the thing to remember, though, that a stem cell transplant is not like going down and getting a flu
yeah.
shot.
Yeah.
That there's a high mortality rate for stem cell transplants. So yeah. in a scientific picture, this is really, really interesting and very, very promising. Mm-hmm. Realistically, can we do stem cell transplants on everyone mm-hmm. with HIV?
Do we know what percentage of the populations lack these or have this particular changes in their immune system that allows this? I mean, it's got to be pretty small percentage, I'm assuming.
It's like 3 to 5.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah. Another question that was asked is there a rapid test now available? So this is the in-home HIV test. Is it available? Is it available in Anchorage? What do we need to know about it?
It is available in Anchorage as of about 2 weeks ago. We know of one source that's now offering the test. It's about $40. that you can buy in the store, take the test home, test yourself, and mail it in, and then you call in and get the test results.
What else do we need to know about it? Is it accurate?
You have to be careful with it because there are false positives. And if it's negative, basically it's negative. They have not seen a lot of false negatives. But there are false positives, and the important part is that this is a screening test. It has to be verified. It has to have a confirmatory test. So that's part of why the call-in. They don't want people to take the test, get a positive, and say, oh, my gosh, I'm HIV positive. What do I do now? They want them to have resources. They want them to be able to talk to someone about the positive test and what the next steps are.
So these people that are doing this, they got to become a doctor for a minute. They got to understand that false negatives and false positives are part and parcel of testing. And we see a lot of false positives because with any screening test, you don't want to miss anything. So we see a lot that appear to be positive but may not be positive. But I want to go back to the false negative for a second. What about the window? I mean, so you just had sex and you think you're at risk. And 2 days later, you go do this oral or this we haven't discovered, talked about how it's done, but or this retail test and it's negative. Is that a guarantee you do not have HIV?
That's an excellent question. And there is a window period. Between the time of infection, it takes about 14 days before the current fourth generation screening blood test that you can get through the state can become positive, but up to 21 days to 3 months for these other tests. The reason why is these are antibody tests.
Yeah, you're waiting for the immune system to respond, and it just takes a while to gin up that stuff. Okay.
They're looking for your body to make the antibodies against the virus. They're looking for that. Mm-hmm. So you're exactly right. If you are concerned that you have put yourself at risk or that you are at risk and your test is negative, you should have non-risky behavior for a month to 3 months and retest yourself. Or remember the acute HIV symptoms of sore throat, lymph nodes, rash, fever, everything that we see this time of year for everybody that comes into the clinics.
And the false positives are people who, for one reason or the other, that test is going to indicate that you might have infection when, in fact, you don't. And, I mean, there's other things in your bloodstream that may turn these antibody tests positive. That's very common in tests that check for antibodies. If you're going to do this, then it's probably, even if you did negative, you probably ought to be talking to somebody if you've had some risky behavior to help you interpret what's the next step here.
Right. And that's when, if you're concerned enough to test yourself, that's when you really need to talk to somebody about safer behaviors, perhaps, and what your risks actually are and how you can change your risks. And that's another place where the 4As comes in. Really strongly as well. They've got excellent counselors that can talk about all that as well.
Is that part of the test as well that
may have access? Yeah, anybody who comes in for an HIV test, part of that is just a counseling session to see why you're there, what are your risk factors, are you in fact at risk? So there's a counseling session that goes on both before and after the test, and it's really important for people to have that. And I think, you know, with the home test, that's a big concern. It's just making sure there's somebody there for people to talk to. And
with the home test, is there also a source for the people to talk to also?
There's a phone number right where they call in. So there is a resource there. So they're not taking it at home and just doing the test themselves and going, oh, I've got a positive.
You know, that's what people want to do. And that's what people are going to do. But the message is you just got to make sure you're getting good information about the results of the test, whether positive and negative. Was it done appropriately? Was the timing correct? What are you going to do with the information that you have now? How does it change your behavior? So there's a lot. That's one of the arguments that came out about, or some of the arguments that came out about whether this ought to be available. Mm-hmm. It makes sense, I guess, to have it available, but it's how we use this information. How's the test done? Do we know that for sure? Is it an oral swab? And then you send it in and you get a result back.
And I think this is a good point or a good spot to interject, too, that there's about 1.2 million people in the United States living with HIV and AIDS. That's an estimated amount. But of that amount, they're estimating about between 18 and 20% of people are infected and don't know they're infected. And that small percentage is probably responsible for over 50% of the new infections that are occurring in the United States, the 56,000 that are occurring every year in the United States, even at this day and age, and has been over the last 15 years. So the CDC in 2006 recommended that everyone between the ages of 13 and 64, and I don't agree with the age limit, I think everyone should be given the opportunity to know their HIV status, and that if your provider doesn't ask you if you would like to be screened, you should ask your provider.
Because as Beth said, you can live for years with this disease without any symptoms whatsoever, and the only way to know is to get tested, so it is something that's encouraged for everybody.
I want to take one phone call, and we're already at 30 minutes through, but I'd like to come back to that, the epidemiology, who, what, when, where, and how, so that people understand now how it's acquired for the primary, for most purposes. And what made me think about it is, people now that, even if it's been 15 or 20 years, it probably didn't come from blood transfusions, and I want people to understand that aspect, because there's still some confusions. But before we get there, Andrew, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I had a burning question, and it's basically, what's the science behind the reasons why homosexuals are more susceptible than other groups? And I'll take the answer offline. Thank you.
Okie doke. So the part of the question I think Andrew's asking is non-heterosexual sex maybe less likely to transmit it than homosexual sex?
Well,
that's kind of the question.
And I think the science behind that, and no pun intended, that transmission is that when there is men who have sex with men and there's anal sex, that the anal canal and the rectal canal is tender tissue, and you can have a lot of tissue disruption that occurs with anal sex, so that you can have the entry of the virus is much easier. Mm-hmm. So the riskiest behavior is being, and I hope I can say this online, is being bottom. Mm-hmm. That's the highest risk that we have sexually transmitted.
So if there's a chance for blood to mix through because of trauma and so forth, mm-hmm. that it absolutely increases the risk, and that probably is the best explanation of why mm-hmm. male homosexual transmission is higher risk than heterosexual transmission. Am I saying that clear enough?
Mm-hmm. And one of the other things that can really make a difference too with that is that any other sexually transmitted disease, rectal gonorrhea, chlamydia, vaginal gonorrhea, chlamydia, herpes, any other sexually transmitted disease can actually increase your risk of transmitting if you're positive, and your risk of acquiring HIV if you're negative by 3 to 5 times. So it's all a tissue, it's all a viral load, the amount of virus in the fluids.
Okay. Well, we're halfway through the program, and I need to take a break. So I want to remind everyone you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to be gone for just about a minute, and then we'll rejoin our guests, Dr. Beth Saltonstall and Heather Davis. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're exploring some basic knowledge and information about HIV and AIDS and some of the resources that are available in Alaska to those who might need to know about them. My guests are Dr. Beth Saltonstall. She's the medical director of the HIV/AIDS Clinical Services at the Native Tribal Health Consortium, and Heather Davis, executive director of the Alaska AIDS Assistance Association. Questions can be sent to us in the next 30 minutes or so by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local phone number is 550-8433, and our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. I do believe the program repeats tonight between 7 and 8. There's a lot of election stuff going on. If I'm wrong, I apologize. But I think we repeat again, as usual, between 7 and 8 tonight. And as usual, I want to make sure people recognize that if you go to line1@alaskapublic.org or alaskapublic.org and look for the Line 1 connection, you can at any time come and listen to the program. You can refer people to our website to listen to the program. So this information does not go away. It's available for you if you'd like to listen at some other time. Karen, you're on line one.
Yes, I just wanted to clarify the in-home test. I believe that is a test that one administers themselves and has the results in 20 minutes. So just for clarification, is that true?
Well, you administer it yourself.
Correct.
I'm going to defer to everybody else because I'm not sure that you get the results that quick, but we may be wrong.
Now, the regular OraQuick test is a 20-minute test, but in the reading that I did for the actual home kit, it was a send-in, and that's why I was interested to hear that it is in the store here in Anchorage. I'm going to go check that out because that is a question.
So, So Karen, we might be wrong, and there may be that you get a quick result.
Well, what we've just done, just to add a little bit to the program, we actually called Walgreens, and it is an in-home test. It's $42.99, and the Walgreens here in town are currently out, but it is an in-home test.
Okay, well, good. Mm. Thanks.
And the test that we use at the 4A's is a 20-minute test. People get their results in 20 minutes. So.
All right.
And it's okay. Free.
And it's free.
I guess one of my thoughts is when it adds another layer of potential error if things are being done at home. You'd say, well, you know, maybe that's all been thought of, and yes, it may, but it's not hard to introduce some variables that may affect these tests. I mean, depending on how well you get the sample, to how long you leave it out, to heat and liquids of other sorts and so forth. So, if there's anything I think we ought to be hearing from this program about the home test is be sure you are getting good advice about the results, whether positive or negative, and talking with someone who can help you understand those results. And because you did it, you probably need to know a little bit more about it anyway. And so the 4A's is available, and I think Beth said you can call her place.
Sure.
And what's that number again?
It's area code 907-729-2907. Some of the things that can cause a false positive are women who've had a lot of pregnancies, a woman who's pregnant, women or people who have hepatitis, autoimmune disorders like lupus or other autoimmune diseases can also give you a false positive. So keep all that in mind as well, that you do need a confirmatory if you are doing this at home.
So there's no perfect test.
Nope.
Remember that. All right. So what's some more about the epidemiology? I mentioned that bloodborne possibilities in the past was everyone probably as well aware as a big problem. Is that no longer a problem?
The chance of getting HIV from a blood product now is about 1 in 3.5 million. The test that we can use to look for HIV in blood now goes down to, in research areas, down to 1 virus per milliliter. So it's actually become a highly sophisticated science on detecting antibodies and the virus itself. So our blood supply is secure.
Okay. Very, very, very safe. Who is at risk?
Are you breathing?
No. I decided I better think about this a little bit more. I am breathing, so I'm at risk. I see where
risk.
That was going. Yeah.
So the largest percentage of the population that we see this disease with is, of course, men having sex with men. In Alaska, it makes up about 49%. Heterosexual contact, though, is the next highest rate that we see, and it's important for people to remember that. So that's our next highest number. And then, of course, the third group that we see it in is injection drug users or the IDU users. So
We're getting some. I got an email that also wants to clarify an issue, and I can see why that needs to be. And that is that anal sex, even among heterosexuals, is at risk, is as risky as with men.
Absolutely, exactly.
So I didn't make that clear. Mm-hmm. It's the potential of blood interacting with other people's blood that is what
in
the
fluids.
Biggest risk was.
It's a fluid.
And we also, I said at the top of the show that even breastfeeding has been is a risk, and that's often not what mothers want to hear, and maybe we should expand if possible on that. I don't think it's as common, but it has been reported is my understanding.
It actually adds about a 12% chance of transmission to your infant for breastfeeding. That's
If a mother is infected.
If the mother is infected. So that's why at this point in time, we encourage all of our mothers not to breastfeed. The other aspect of this that has become more pronounced as well or more common knowledge is pre-masticating food is also a risk for mothers who are positive with their infants. So we encourage mothers not to pre-masticate their food.
Mm-hmm. That's chewing the food up, making it easier for babies to swallow, more safe for them to swallow, except for the fact that they may be introducing infection.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. So if a woman is HIV positive, does not mean she cannot have children. We've had many successful deliveries. We haven't had any children that have been infected, infants that have been infected. But the important part is to, number one, be diagnosed. Number two, be in care, take your meds. And if your viral load, the amount of virus that we see in a milliliter of blood, is below 1,000 at delivery time, and the mother can actually have a normal vaginal delivery of her child.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to get at. So what in my mind, I was thinking, when you treat these individuals who are infected, the viral load, that is the amount of virus that can be found in their bloodstream, decreases. And so that is what causes decreased likelihood of the transmission. And it also, I assume, if a mother's viral load is pretty low, then breastfeeding is is less likely? Or do you still not recommend
transfusion? Never recommend it.
I didn't realize that. Yeah. I know active tuberculosis is a reason. So it's on the absolute contraindication list of breastfeeding that I need to update in my home computer here.
The reason being is that the viral load in the blood, the viral load in the serum, does not necessarily mimic the viral load either in vaginal fluid, seminal fluid, or breast milk. So even if your viral load is undetectable, you may have virus in other fluids. So if your serum viral load is undetectable, there may be virus in other areas. That's why we say there's never a viral load too low that you are not at risk of transmitting, and there's not a viral load that's so high that you transmit 100% of the time.
What about other things that people may do to help prevent transmission of the virus? I'm thinking of families where a couple where one partner has HIV, and what can they do to decrease the likelihood of transmission to their sexual partner?
Well, condoms are still highly effective in preventing HIV infection when they're used consistently, which is key. You have to use them every time and correctly also. So condoms are still one of the best ways to prevent HIV infection for anybody who's sexually active to use a condom. Latex being the best, but if you have an allergy to latex, there are other condoms out there, polyurethane or plastic. But it's important that you use them correctly.
And the FDA has just approved PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis. It's a combo drug. It's one pill once a day. It's a combination of tenofovir and emtricitabine, two of the drugs that we use to treat HIV. And if the negative partner takes that medication every day, and their partner who is positive is on their antiretrovirals and has their virus under control, then that doesn't eliminate condom use, but the risk of transmission is certainly dramatically decreased. They have actually found that treatment is our best prevention for HIV at this point. That getting that viral load down is the most important aspect we have for prevention.
Yeah, that's always made sense to me. It was funny that it took a long time. I guess it's like the way science works. We needed the really, really good evidence before we started making those recommendations. Mm-hmm. Is basically what it boils down to.
And with PrEP, they had good numbers, but the good numbers were in those people that actually took the drug. Mm-hmm. So this is not something that you order online and you take on Friday to go out on Saturday. Right. This is a lifetime mm-hmm. change. This is a commitment to care.
Another thing, and I was reading an email that I want to get to here in a second, Heather, that I don't know that you may have commented on, and that's the syringe exchange or needle exchange programs. And I think if there's an area where there may be misconceptions about policy, this mm-hmm. may be one. Can you help us understand the policy decisions to do this?
Well, one of the things we know is that not having clean syringes available is one of the largest indicators of having HIV, contracting HIV, because the IDU population also often has no access to clean syringes. And part of that is the stigma around their behavior. So prior to there being a syringe exchange, individual pharmacies and policy practices disallowed or discouraged the sale of clean needles to the IDU population. It really works around a harm reduction, what's called a harm reduction model, which helps to address the negative consequences of drug use. And what it does, it reduces the sharing of injection equipment, it gets needles off the streets, it increases community safety because of that. We are able to get people referred to treatment. We give them clean needles and the other pieces of equipment that they need to be sure they're not infecting others. And it allows us to refer them to services. It allows us to educate them. Makes their injection drug use screening safer, and we give them safe sex kits and HIV tests. So it really, we hope it works to decrease this population being exposed to HIV and hepatitis C, which is a huge problem in other infectious diseases.
So other bloodborne mm-hmm. transmission. Mm-hmm. And I think before we came on the air, you mentioned that this is one of the most successful preventative mm-hmm. programs that mm-hmm. we have.
Mm-hmm. If you look at the numbers of new cases in different groups of people, it's actually the IV drug users that have access to needle exchange programs. That's the group of people that have seen the greatest decrease in the numbers of new cases of HIV.
Yeah, and IV drug use is a huge problem in Alaska right now. I think we've seen the stories recently on the heroin use, and we've gotten calls from bush communities looking to how they could set up needle exchange programs. It's because we know it works.
How many needles do you exchange a month?
We are up to about 25,000 needles a month that we exchange at the 4-A's.
Mm. Wow. Yeah,
that's huge. Yeah.
That surprised me.
It does make you take it does make you sit back and take a breath.
I
yes,
did not
I was
know that one.
I was surprised too. Yeah, absolutely.
To how many different individuals are the 25,000 needles given?
Ooh,
do you know that off the top of your head?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what I saw last, and I want to say 700.
Okay.
Approximately.
Okay. All right, if you've got questions or comments, we're into our last 15 minutes or so. Our local number is 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Now, here's a question that came in by email, and I'm going to read it. And, Beth, it says for you, I'm sure, and I'm going to say you're not going to know the answer, so we're going to generalize the question, which I think one of us can probably answer. But I want to address that. It says, all I can find out about the retrovirus, caprine arthritis encephalitis, is that it is not transmissible to humans. Can this be trusted? It is passed between goats and sheep. Why not to humans in time? So the question really more generally is, again, I don't know what caprine arthritis encephalitis is, but the issue is there are retroviruses in many species, and why do not these similar viruses or even other viruses that are not retroviruses jump species more often than they do? And if they do, and this is what's interesting about the story about HIV that we might want to get into, even if it does, then it's how likely is it to spread? You know, so that's the real issue. Even if it does jump once, how then does it get to somebody else?
I think the issue with this was probably the fact that this is a simian virus, and our genetics are so closely related to chimpanzees that the simian immunodeficiency virus actually has a strong genetic concordance with the human immunodeficiency virus. And because of our like genetics and numbers of genes and everything else, I think that's why HIV could catch hold. The idea that they have with why did it take hold in humans and why are we just seeing it now is there probably has been HIV for many, many years, but that's been contained in pockets and people have died from the disease and not traveled or not done, gone outside their circle. With the simian virus at this point, chimpanzees and monkeys can have simian virus and never get sick. They've had this for a long, long time and have gotten somewhere in the scope of history, you know, have gotten to the point where they can live with it. But I think that would be my first thought is that this isn't bovine or ovine or whatever a goat is, but it is a simian that's so closely related to us.
So many viruses are somewhat species specific, even those that aren't retroviruses. Mm-hmm. And there's the measles virus, there's the viruses, I can't remember, and others, animals that are similar. I want to just take a second to talk about the HIV thing. As I understand it from reading and interviewing on this program, a man who went back and looked at all of this, because I think it's extremely interesting, is why this thing, which may have jumped species a couple of times at this particular time, really went out of control. And it gets to the point is, yeah, somebody probably was butchering a certain kind of monkey and got contaminated with blood. But then sexual transmission really is not that efficient to really say that this exploded and became a worldwide epidemic. And what really appears to have happened is there was a lot of good intention things going on in the Belgian Congo way back in the 40s and 50s to try to prevent spread of disease, and these involved injections, and it was very difficult to sterilize these equipment, and that inadvertently a lot of things got spread person to person through injections, and then it got into the blood supply in a very interesting way through in Haiti, which is an interesting story. But these viruses do jump, but then they have to have some technique and mechanism to really expand that infection. And it turns out sexual transmission is probably not good enough for many things. And especially if it kills you pretty quick, then it's not going to be very successful at it promoting itself.
Yeah, there's a lot of theories behind how, and I think that's a really exciting read that you did
All right.
on the scope.
What else do we need to talk about here? What are some messages that I haven't left? Misconceptions is always an important question.
Yeah, there are still a lot of misconceptions out there. And one of them is that people don't think they need to worry about HIV because the drugs are out there, so they don't see it and don't understand that, as Beth mentioned, yeah, there are drugs out there, but this is care and treatment that you need for the rest of your life. And staying on, as anybody knows who's ever had to take medication, it's hard to stay on medications long-term, and this is something that you need to do long-term. People who say they're straight or they don't use IV drugs, so they think they will not become positive. If they're receiving treatment, they often think that they can't spread the disease, which we know isn't true. People think they can tell if somebody's HIV positive, that for some reason they'll know. People think they can't get HIV from oral sex, and I think that's really important to note that you can. People think they're safe if they're just having oral sex, and that's not necessarily true. So I think those are some of the misconceptions. So any others, Beth?
Yeah, here's a misconception that came in. The question is, what would you say to someone who thinks HIV is a concern of the 80s and 90s, not a concern of today's youth?
Come to my clinic.
So there are 56,000 new cases per year is what you're saying.
I think that idea that this is for people other than me, regardless of what age you are, regardless of what race or where you live, it's always going to be someone else. But if you are engaging in sexual behavior or needle behavior, you are at risk.
No matter what your age.
No matter what your age, exactly. Yeah. And with youth, youth didn't see the 80s. Mm. They didn't see it. So they don't have that sort of fear factor in the background.
It's the same problem we're having with vaccination, denial of vaccination. People have not seen polio. They haven't seen measles. Right. They haven't seen, we're beginning to see pertussis again, a slightly different issue. But these are very nasty illnesses. Here's another, comes from a HIV surveillance coordinator and wants to ask us to talk about the internet and how seeking anonymous partners online increases the risk of HIV acquisition.
Yes, that's an excellent question. And in recent years, the internet has become more and more available to people everywhere, and so have the services that people offer over the internet. One of the highest risk groups that we have seen in the last couple of years, and we had what they called an outbreak of HIV from the end of 2011, the first part of 2012, where primarily men who have sex with men were finding partners online and having anonymous sexual partners without investigating disease possibilities or using condoms. So the ease of finding partners is there. The internet is sort of a media which is making it easier to find partners wherever you are. And unsafe sex has come back into vogue, which is terrifying. So the warning I would have for people who do, you know, use the internet to find partners is that if you do, use a condom. Even if the person says, no, I'm clean, use a condom. Because, like we'd said before, 25% of people, 20 to 25% of people don't know they're infected. So they may not know that they're infected.
Mm-hmm. And then we have that over 50, 55 population.
Oh, yeah.
Postmenopausal women, not at risk for pregnancy, think they're too old to get sexually transmitted diseases on some level. And I think that's another population that thinks they're maybe not at risk for this. And they absolutely are.
Mm-hmm. Here's kind of a sophisticated question that gets right to the same issue here. It says, are most people in Alaska finding out about their HIV status by screening tests or by a diagnostic test? What is the basis of, what's this guy trying to ask?
Now, that's another good question, because a screening test is you're looking at asymptomatic people. You're screening for disease that you don't know is there. Diagnostic test, you're looking for a disease in someone who's coming to you with symptoms. And about 48% of the people who are newly diagnosed in Alaska are being diagnosed with AIDS at the time of their diagnosis of HIV. That's a diagnostic test. So we do see screening positivities. The prenatal testing in Alaska is excellent. And we have had cases of young women who have been tested positive through their screening test for prenatal. And that is a screening test. But by and large, we are seeing most of our cases through diagnostic testing. That's a great question. Mm. And that's where the 4As would come in for screening. It's important to know your background.
Vaccines are probably, not just my opinion, but the evidence is one of the most effective public health treatments, efforts that have been made in the history of mankind. If you look at the benefits compared to risks. And we're constantly developing new vaccines. Where are we in the prevention of human immunodeficiency virus vaccines? And if you can, what's the problem? Why haven't we got there?
Well, when we first started doing this job in 2002, they told us we're going to have a vaccine in 5 to 10 years. And in 2003, it was 10 to 20 years. And in 2005, it was 25 years. And in 2007, we're nowhere close. It's back on the table again. Both vaccine and cure are back on the table because some of the recent science that's come through. Vaccines, HIV is a really smart virus. It's able to mutate. It can get around a lot of the drugs if they're not taken appropriately. It can become resistant to the medications. So to find a vaccine in the human realm for HIV has been a really elusive and a difficult problem. They've had a lot of trials. Some of them have been successful. Most of them have not. It's back on the table again, but sort of overshadowing that is actually cure. They have discovered that they're in HIV, you've got all this virus that's running around in your blood, and that's a problem. But one of the bigger problems is that you've also got virus that sequesters itself and is latent in different tissue. The virus in your blood lives about an hour to 3 hours, and the virus in your sequestered virus can be a half-life of about 6 months. So why can't we cure people if we've got them on these HIV meds and they're undetectable? Why doesn't the virus go away? It's because of that sequestered virus that will come back, and it would take almost 60 years of being undetectable to get rid of it. Mm-hmm. So what they're finding, they're looking for a cure now, which I think we're going to find probably before we find a vaccine, is they have discovered a chemotherapy drug that actually pulls that virus, the sequestered virus, out of this latent virus that's sitting in these other tissues, will pull it out so the body can get rid of it and the meds can get rid of it. So I think actually in the vaccine and cure business, we're probably going to see a cure before we see a vaccine. And the scope of you know, treating people and trying to roll out a cure, this is really going to be interesting to see. I think it's going to happen. I'm optimistic. I think it's going to happen.
I wanted to hear more about this and make the comment that that's similar to herpes viruses that have a lifelong immunity and sometimes sequester, and tuberculosis. So there's other infections that kind of hide out for a while and come back, but we don't have time. So in the last couple of minutes, I like to always leave. What do we want people to hear? Heather, from your standpoint, what do we want everybody to come away from?
That HIV is still out there, that people need to be tested, that they need to practice safe sexual behaviors. And it hasn't gone away, and it's important for people to remember that.
I want to be out of a job.
Yeah.
And the only way I can do that is if our prevention efforts work, and if people know their status and can get into care and get good care to take care of themselves and the people that they care for.
Anybody who goes to Line 1 at alaskapublic.org, alaskapublic.org, and looks for Line 1, you can find some good links. Dr. Saltonstall's clinic number, again, is 907-729-2907. There's a link to the Alaska AIDS Assistance Association on our website. You got a phone number?
263-2050.
So there's ample ways for people to get more information about this particular problem, which can be controlled with everybody's help, it sounds like.
We're a team.
We are.
Thanks very much for taking the time to be with us and to share this information again.
Thank you.
If they want to donate to help, call either one of the clinics, I suspect. Is
Absolutely.
That right?
Absolutely.
Call the 4As.
4As,
mm-hmm.
Okay. Alaska AIDS Assistance Association.
Yep.
Next week, let me say thanks again. This has been Dr. Beth Saltonstall, who has been with us. She's the medical director of the HIV and AIDS Clinical Services at the Native Tribal Health Consortium. And the other person you've been listening to today is Heather Davis, executive director of the Alaska AIDS Assistance Association. So, and as usual, if you want to continue the conversation, you can do that by joining KSKA on Facebook. There's a link on our website. Our guest next week is a Brandeis University health economist, Dr. Stuart Altman. Dr. Altman has assisted with 5 presidents in their efforts to design an equitable national health insurance program. He recently has published and written a book on some of the inside accounts of his involvement in the events that led to the passage of Obama's Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. So why don't you tune in to your health and learn some more about our country's efforts to provide universal health care coverage next Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.